Not going to talk about this in great detail, simply that's not the topic of the talk, but just to say there was an extra-dimensional way of kind of using extra dimensions as the filter for this Planck slop. But there were also questions raised. Basically, this was fleshed out in papers which were really five-dimensional effective field theory papers, and but trying to do a full checklist from an effective field theory point of view. However, these were criticized to some extent, or at least questioned, by people trying to say, well, within our understanding of string theory, can you get into this ballpark in the first place? Okay, this is a robust ballpark in the sense that small changes preserve sequestering, but would you even be placed in this kind of thing? Part of the problem was this filter was this very pristine extra dimension with only the minimal inhabitants, or light inhabitants, namely supergravity. Whereas string theories have lots of inhabitants, moduli, other fields, and so on, which could also be light, and they might screw up sequestering. Okay, so at least that was a criticism. The other thing is, therefore, you rely, partly the problem is that this story that you're telling is a non-renormalizable story, higher dimensional field theory. And therefore, you at least pay a little bit of attention to what the string theorists say, because they're giving you a UV completion, right? So one alternative is to ask, is there an approach which is renormalizable? You still, somewhere out there, there's still quantum gravity, so you still need to fit it into string theory in some way. However, it's like gauge mediation or something, or QCD. Okay, QCD is a nice renormalizable theory. We don't necessarily have to ask, it's nice to ask, but it's not necessary to ask, is there a string theory which contains QCD? It's because we feel comfortable with the QCD dynamics on its own, and we're willing to test it experimentally. Okay, so the question is there a renormalizable path where I don't have to ask questions or I'm not sensitive to the UV completion? Now, on route to that, so that's what conformal sequestering is. And just to give credit where it's due, there was a version of conformal sequestering with some dynamical assumptions that came up in the context of the Gino-mediated supersymmetry breaking. But I will be mostly focusing on anomaly mediation, just because that's what I've worked on. So it turns out that the use of an extra dimension to do this sequestering job, and I'll tell you again exactly what that is in a second, to do this sequestering job can be done also in a warped higher dimensional space-time. You do not need flat extra dimensions, okay? And basically these aspects were worked out, and I'd like to at least talk about some aspects a little later at the end of the conformal sequestering talk. But of course, when you can see how to do things in warped extra dimensional effective field theory, you naturally say there must be some sort of CFT version of the same ideas, and maybe I can get rid of this five-dimensional story and replace it by some four-dimensional conformal field theory that I actually understand in terms of renormalizable physics, that is, it's under theoretical control. So the advantage is, by switching to the CFT picture rather than this extra-dimensional picture, that you don't have to deal with the non-normalizable higher-dimensional gravity, that you don't have to deal with n equals 2 supersymmetry, or minimal amount of supersymmetry for the And the other thing is that you get into a class of ideas which involve conformal field theories, strongly coupled conformal field theories, but the class is broader than the things that have nice geometric duals, okay? So you actually get into a broader space. And you deal with only n equals 1 supersymmetry because the extra supersymmetry is accidentally there at a conformal fixed point. But the parent theory that runs to the conformal fixed point, you only have to keep track of n equals 1, which means that average Joe's can lose. Okay? So I want to just give a one transparency on most of the supergravity I know. So includes anomaly mediation. So let me just say what that is, because that's going to be our target. Sequestering is the thing that's going to allow what I say here to dominate the soft masses. So we all know general coordinate invariance is the, if you like, gauge symmetry of gravity, and roughly speaking, these are like the gauge fields. I want to take out of this a subgroup of the diffeomorphisms to supersymmetrize. Of course, full supergravity supersymmetrizes this whole gauge field. Just to focus on what I want, let me keep the subgroup of conformal transformations, thought of as coordinate transformations. Okay. If you do that, then in some sense the only gauge field, if you like, in quotes, that you need is this scalar degree of freedom. You can just keep Minkowski space up to this Weyl rescaling. And if you only do conformal coordinate transformations, then all that will happen is the phi will change to some other phi. Okay, that is what conformal transformations are.
I'm confused. In 40, you're just thinking of the finite dimensional group here?
Yeah, or? Exactly. Okay. So that's all I need to tell my story. Okay. And then I'll come back and tell you what difference it makes when you really do supergravity, you know, full supergravity. But this will allow you to focus on science. Okay, so then you say, okay, fine. I'm supposed to focus on this one scalar degree of freedom. It's an off-shell degree of freedom of the metric. Okay. Now, I need to supersymmetrize. I see a scalar. I see n equals 1 Suzy, so it must be part of a chiral superfield. So that's capital Phi. And this is the famous compensator of supergravity, but I'm just explaining it this way. Okay. And the importance of this is that this chiral superfield is the only part of the full supergravity theory that can get Lorentz invariant VEVs, okay? Everything else that I dropped by this simplification cannot get a Lorentz invariant VEV. That is to say, it carries a space-time index, like a gravitino or a auxiliary field, which is a vector field or something like that. Okay, so these are the things that are going to give us VEVs, and so I focus on those. But this way of saying it also tells you that this conformal invariant, so is part of the gauge symmetry. Okay, it's a symmetry under coordinate transformations which are conformal. So I must keep it exact. It's an exact part of the coordinate invariance of the theory. So that means if I want to couple this supergravity to matter, here's matter. Maybe there are some Yukawa couplings. I'm throwing away indices. There may be some gauge field strengths. There may be ordinary kinetic terms for the matter. And I have to couple phi exactly so as to maintain the conformal invariance of the theory. Now it's easy to see what phi has to do. Everywhere there is a mass scale, phi must multiply the mass scale so that the theory becomes conformally invariant. Okay? But in this kind of typical renormalizable field theory, let me just throw away any mass terms, okay, just to keep the discussion simple. The only mass scale in town is actually the renormalization group scale, mu, okay, which means that we know exactly where phi should appear. It should appear here, and by holomorphy it's phi and not phi dagger. It has to appear here in the wave function renormalization factor for the matter fields. But it's the absolute value. That's something you can work out by thinking about R symmetries. I won't bother with that. But basically, you're told where the phi appears. Okay. So this is the renormalized expression for the phi dependence that supergravity insists on. Now, in fact, if we were working classically, of course, there's no mu dependence at all, and phi would just disappear from here. Okay. So, and that's just true. Classically, this is a scale invariant theory, a conformally invariant theory, and there's no phi dependence. But quantum mechanically, the phi is here, and f phi, which is the scalar supergravity auxiliary field, the only scalar supergravity auxiliary field, if it's non-zero, then that's a sign of supersymmetry breaking in flat space. Okay. So, what you find when you cancel the cosmological constant is that if you have supersymmetry breaking in some hidden sector, that the going rate for f phi is the hidden sector f term divided by m Planck. Okay. So it's a little bit seesawed down by the Planck scale.
Wait, how do the units work? Sorry.
Phi is dimensionless because it's a graviton. The gravitino mass is roughly given by F phi. This is the mass, this is the gravitino mass. However, if you work out all the masses here, let's just do one case, the Gaugino mass, say. I need to expand this gauge coupling function, running gauge coupling function. I need to expand it in superspace and pick out the F phi term and get a Gaugino mass. And that expansion, because I have to differentiate tau with respect to mu, I necessarily get something proportional to the beta function of the theory. Okay? So you get beta function times F. And of course, the beta function is a one loop effect. So this is some order alpha in the standard model effect times this. So if this is has to be, say, 30 TeV or 50 TeV the going rate, so that one loop factor times it will turn out to be of order TeV or hundreds of TeV. Okay? So that's the way it works. You can work out what the scalar masses are. If you think this one through, you have to actually play with a piece of paper to figure out that you actually get scalar mass squareds, which are two loop. And everything is given in terms of the RG functions of the theory, okay, A terms and so on. Now, the nice thing is that the dynamics of the squarks is dominated by their gauge interactions, say QCD. And therefore, these soft masses are flavor blind. If this was the only contribution to visible soft masses, then this would at least be flavor blind and interesting. Okay. So let me just say a few things about the vices and virtues of anomaly mediation, just phenomenologically. Okay. One virtue is the gravitino is considerably heavier than the TeV scale. That ameliorates the cosmological gravitino problem, that gravitino will decay after nucleosynthesis and screw up the predictions of nucleosynthesis. But by raising the mass, the higher it gets, the more you eat into that problem. The flavor blindness, I already pointed out. The other thing is, just a broad point in its favor, is we are now in the situation where I think we have not seen supersymmetry, and it worries a large number of the model builders that we have. And I mean that they even march with their feet. That is, people who were very invested in it at some level have started to look at other alternatives. It's not like anybody's given up on supersymmetry. That would be far too premature. It's just, it's troubling. So you start to broaden your view of what might happen at the weak scale. Think split supersymmetry. People were not just doing that for fun. In some sense, there's a set of non-observations that are pushing people. But so therefore, normally, things that we disregard, for example, we all know the hierarchy problem is caused by quadratic divergences. Supersymmetry solves that problem. However, it still leaves log divergences, as it turns out. Contributions to the Higgs mass that maybe go like n stop squared, that's cutting off the quadratic divergence, multiplied by logs that go up to the Planck scale. Okay. Even those logs start to hurt you at this point. Even the logs are starting to hurt you. Now, one of the virtues of things like anomaly mediation, but this is the simplest and clearest case, is there are no large logs. In these formulas, all the large logs, sensitivity to the Planck scale, is resummed in the gauge coupling itself. If you work in terms of the infrared gauge couplings, you have no more large log sensitivity to the Planck scale. Okay? It's all resummed for you. So that's some useful power that I see in terms of model building. It's something to keep in mind, that you might have something that's not so sensitive to the Planck scale. Now, having said that, let me say the negative thing. Literally, the negative thing is that the Slepton masses, mass squareds, are negative if you plug in the MSSM. Okay. So that's bad, because tachyonic Sleptons means that they condense and you, say, break electromagnetism. Okay. So it's bad. This is if you apply it, if you literally say anomaly mediation is the only thing going on, and you apply it to the MSSM, so you say the MSSM is the only thing going on, then the model is technically just dead, dead on arrival. However, there are two approaches, both have been followed and both have satisfactory answers. You can look at non-minimal models, say models which involve singlets as well as the MSSM, so like some extension of the MSSM, which actually give you positive mass squares. Okay, so it give you a viable spectrum. That was something that was done by Ratazzi and Pomerol. The other thing that's been done, which I think is, again, a very broad class, is hybrids of anomaly mediation with other mediation schemes, where they naturally come out to give sort of competing contributions to soft masses. So there are sort of certain types of gauge mediation that can coexist with anomaly mediation. And usefully, you might say, why should I do both? I'll just go with gauge. They can usefully do that in terms of the model building and the phenomenology of those scales. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say about the model building. I want to take anomaly mediation as a case study. You can decide you don't like that particular thing, but I want to take it as a case study for sequestering in general. As I said, there are several mechanisms which are consistent, which require sequestering. Anomaly mediation, because it's going to be the simplest for what we're about to do. And the thing we are focusing on now, from now on, is this Planck's law. So I told you, there, I gave you a formula for all the soft masses. But those soft masses coming from this, well, to get zero cosmological constant, you better have had some supersymmetry breaking in a hidden sector somewhere. And you could easily...
When you have to add other things to get anomaly mediation to work, how do those other things change the sequestering scenario?
Yeah, there's two. So let me go through those two scenarios again. In one, you change the visible sector. You demand complete sequestering. For example, I'll show you how that can happen. And but because it's not the MSSM, the formulas are different, and you don't get you get a viable spectrum. You don't get tachyonic leptons. That's one where you don't require a breakdown of sequestering. There's another type of game which I worked out actually in the conformal sequestering scenario, where there's a break in sequestering. There are three sectors: hidden sector, visible sector, and what I'll call messenger sectors. And for a very simple reason, I could tell you by the end of this talk, but not right now, the messenger sector can talk directly to the hidden sector, but the visible sector and the hidden sector are sequestered, okay? And that automatically gives a kind of gauge-mediated effect that is parametrically and numerically competitive with anomaly mediation. We can talk about that at the very end. Here is what I mean by the technical face of sequestering, or what you're supposed to do. You could always have visible sector fields multiplied by hidden sector fields. Everything can be gauge invariant because they're bilinears of both. And of course, this is higher dimension operator, but it could be suppressed by the Planck scale. In fact, generically, you would expect there are operators suppressed by the Planck scale like this. And if I just put in flavor indices and give some coefficients of order one here, then there are flavor-dependent masses here. Now, once the hidden sector fields get some Susie-breaking VEV, this is going to turn into a mass term for the scalars of the MSSM, or whatever SSM you're talking about, with flavor-violating mixing mass matrices, okay? So this will then, first of all, given this rate, so this is going to be F hidden sector squared here, okay? So what you're going to get are squark masses which scale like F hidden sector over M Planck from this source, whereas from anomaly mediation, you're going to get F phi times alpha as the anomaly mediated mass. That means that anomaly mediation is alpha down from this effect. So if this effect is there, forget about anomaly mediation, it's small potatoes. This is what dominates, and you're at the mercy of whatever string theory hands you here. Now, that might be okay if you can come up with a string theory which does this right, okay, does it nicely, but the effective field theory approach is to assume the worst from the string theories, the worst possible things can happen. And then to say, what are we going to do with this? This is dominating, okay? So conformal sequestering, which is like the AES-CFD jewel of this extra-dimensional sequestering, has a very, very simple plot. This is the Lagrangian renormalized at the string scale. This is how I inherited in the worst possible form I can imagine. But of course, I have to run this Lagrangian down to lower energies, to the Susie breaking scale, before actually deciding what effects this has. And if there's a lot of running, strong running, then that can change the quick dimensional analysis conclusions that I drew here. Okay, so that's where conformal sequestering could come in. So let me say it as broadly as I can, give you what the plot is. This is a kind of initial condition for the Lagrangian. Okay, it's the effect of Lagrangian at the highest scales. It's the initial condition for the RG, and we're going to run down. So what we want is a theory which, what kind of theory has amnesia about initial conditions? What's the name of the class of theories which are amnesiac about their initial conditions? And the answer is strongly coupled infrared attractive conformal field theories. An infrared attractive fixed point is one that slowly forgets all the deviations from the fixed point at the highest scales. So let's just see exactly how that works. Let me give you the big plot, and then we'll see what loopholes there are to this otherwise happy story. Okay. So it is assumed that somewhere near the Planck scale or string scale, that we are at least given the visible sector, whatever visible sector you want, and a hidden sector, which is, however, not some random theory. It's actually given to you as a conformal field theory. Okay, so, or it rapidly flows to a conformal field theory. It rapidly gets to a fixed point somewhere just below the Planck scale. So that's the hidden sector. And we're assuming, for this purpose, we can talk about messing the story up a little, but for this purpose, I'm assuming that any moduli or whatever stuff you get in string theory have been stabilized at the highest scales. So that's done. Okay. Once this is done, we have to run the hidden sector plus visible sector plus gravity, and we have to run down to the intermediate scale, which is the scale at which the hidden sector breaks supersymmetry. Okay, that's just the definition of the intermediate scale. And roughly, if you put in the numbers, that's somewhere around 10 to the 11 GV or so. Okay. So the grand plot is, I want the hidden sector to be this conformal field theory because it'll have large anomalous dimensions. It can change the canonical dimensional analysis I did here. But I also want it to break supersymmetry. So somewhere there has to be a mass scale that tells the hidden sector, stop being conformal. Do something else, like break supersymmetry. And that's what this mass scale and the hidden sector is. Okay, so somewhere a little bit above the Susie breaking scale, there has to be a transition in the hidden sector dynamics. Okay, so we're running from here down to just a little above the supersymmetry breaking scale. So several orders of magnitude, several decades of energy. Now, operators like this, I'm just going to write it more generally, are hidden sector operators multiplied by visible sector operators. Okay, and now I have the renormalization group running down, and basically the hidden sector operators are the ones which contain quarks and gluons which are strongly interacting, whatever this CFT is made out of. So they get, the leading effect is they get some anomalous dimensions in their scaling from here down to here, and that corrects what you would naively have assumed, which is what I get at the beginning is what I get at the end. That's how I just did this analysis. But now there's this extra factor. And in principle, if these gammas are order one, which requires strongly coupled conformal field theories, and mu, say the final mu is something around a little bit above the intermediate scale, we could expect to get, say, 10 to the minus 6 out of this red factor here, which is roughly what you need to kill this adequately so that it does not show up in any experimental tests. Okay, we're not sensitive to it experimentally. Okay, so that's the plan. And then once you're done, somewhere here, you have to just get rid of this hidden sector mass, or you integrate out some of the conformal matter. You get left, hopefully, with some model that breaks supersymmetry, and boom, you're done. And of course, what we'd like is both an existence proof as well as some understanding of how robust this picture is, like how many times in the landscape is this going to happen, okay? That's what we'd like. Good. So sorry.
Dumb question.
Yeah.
Are you just putting this extra scale in by hand?
This one?
Yeah.
In the simplest version of the story, which I want to get through first, yes, but it can be generated dynamically in the sense that you can have non-perturbative effects that can generate this kind of mass scale. I gather that there is a paper by Dine and Silverstein and somebody else or something. I think they're calling it retrofitting or, well, I didn't read their paper in detail, but I think they talk about how you can try and generate these kind of mass scales. We gave an example. I'll show you this at the end, okay, how you can generate this mass scale. But the coincidence of these two scales is not a big deal. That is, given this sort of mass scale, once you have it, something happens and you break supersymmetry. That hopefully is quite generic. So let me show you how that works. As I said, these all come into the class of how robust is this. And I'd rather tell you what it is, and then we talk about the robustness as part of the discussion. The fact that, of course, it would be deadly if these gammas went with the opposite sign, right? If they were negative or something. But it's precisely operators, it's precisely in theories which are infrared attractive fixed points where all of these gammas are positive. Okay, that's the definition of these of conformal fixed points. Because any of these, you can think of this as just a number that you're adding or coefficient to these operators. And these operators then could just be thought of as perturbations of the fixed point Lagrangian. And of course, to say it's an attractive fixed point means that as you go down in energy, these perturbations scale away. The gammas are positive. Well, there is a loophole to this. And the catch is there's both a loophole, and the loophole is also the lamppost by which we study these strongly coupled theories. It's called symmetry. So clearly, understanding the properties of the zoo of conformal field theories we have at present has been greatly aided by symmetries. And I stress these are, for our purposes, hidden sector flavor symmetries. They've got nothing to do with visible sector flavor symmetry, okay? At least not in this story. but of course, if you have global symmetries, you have symmetry currents. So here, imagine these X's have fermion psi. Here is a typical current, flavor current, with some generator sitting here. And these currents sit inside supermultiplets like this, okay? This vector field made out of the product of these two chirals. Which means that by supersymmetry, the vanishing of anomalous dimensions of this conserved current implies the vanishing of anomalous dimensions of this, okay? We might as well just call this a conserved current. But you see, that's exactly one of the types of terms that might appear multiplying the visible sector. Okay, so this operator, as I run it down, since this is a conserved current, even though the going rate is anomalous dimensions of order 1, there's a special reason why this has zero anomalous dimension. Running it down, you don't do anything. And it's unsuppressed. And it comes back to kill you. Okay, so it's dangerous. Well, we have to ask how dangerous. We have to go through some cases. But that's, in fact, part of this recent paper is categorizing these dangers. And you find that often they're not as dangerous as you first thought. But let's agree that in terms of the big plot I just gave you, this looks like trouble. Okay. Actually, you can ask, why is it we called it an attractive fixed point if there are things I can add to the Lagrangian, which are Lorentz invariant, integral d4 theta of this, which actually are marginal. That why do we even call it an attractive fixed point? And the answer is, this is the loophole, that if you do integral d4x, integral d4 theta, t x dagger x. So remember, I'm saying this is a part of a conserved current. It's in the same supermultiplet as a conserved current, hence it has zero anomalous dimension. Everything is a function of ordinary spacetime x. This is a non-trivial operator. It could multiply visible sector fields, and it is the cause of all the trouble. That's the danger. But if you just imagine adding it to the Lagrangian like this, without any visible sector fields at all, then this is a kind of a projection of this operator onto zero momentum. Okay? And it turns out these operators are completely redundant. If you like, they're just changing the kinetic terms of the X dagger X in some flavor-dependent way, and you can completely rotate them away. Okay? What makes this a non-trivial operator is when you have an X-dependent coefficient, otherwise known as the visible sector. Once it's X-dependent, this is a non-trivial operator. But with this a constant coefficient, it is a trivial operator that you can actually rotate it away. Okay. So this is the subtle loophole that we've got trapped in terms of our general plot. But anyway, we do have to worry about it. Okay, so this is the main obstacle to sequestering. And so the natural thing to do is symmetries and theories with lots of symmetry are the key to understanding the theory, given strong coupling. But maybe we can try and kick our starting theories towards less symmetry by adding deformations. So this is the topic of what I'll call designer CFTs. It's very analogous to sort of the KKLT-like thing. You start with theories with no modulus stabilization. They're very simple. Everybody understands them. And then you slowly add crap here and there and try and put them in an understandable way to some example that you actually can trust. This is, in some sense, the CFT dual of that kind of thinking. But anyway, that doesn't appeal to you. Designer CFTs. The idea is you start with, you know, for example, an asymptotically free theory. This is a typical thing. You have some relevant deformation. It may be gauge coupling. It runs to a non-perturbative fixed point. That has far too many symmetries. It's going to be deadly for sequestering. So you add deformations to that, which take you to other fixed points with fewer symmetries, and so on. And this is certainly a game that was being played by field theorists for a long time. You didn't have to reinvent those things. The idea of using it for sequestering is it's got a more recent history. And so this is the landscape that we have to deal with, okay, the landscape of these CFTs and their properties, and the fact that the closer we are to here, the more we understand the landscape, but often the theories we're interested in are a few sites removed. Okay. So the question is, find an example that does the job of sequestering. I'll show you one very, very simple example. But of course, more broadly, what we're trying to think is how generic and plausible is conformal sequestering where you're not being killed by these conserved currents? How likely is that to happen in the landscape of conformal field theory? And a very important tool for investigating this landscape is basically Intrilligator and anybody else. There's a number of papers, but starting with Intrilligator and Weck, the ideas of A maximization are critical tools in figuring out what's going on. Okay, so what's nice in this recent work with Martin, there are examples with Marcus Luthi that I had from earlier, which were more complicated, but here is this dead simple example, and it's incredibly simple because it leeches off the Intrilligator Seiberg Shi model of supersymmetry breaking, which in itself is incredibly simple. Okay, so here it is. The hidden sector, this renormalizable theory I'm showing you, consists of SUSY QCD. Here are the quarks of SUSY QCD, X and X dagger, X and X bar, left-handed, right-handed quarks. But we are going to add an adjoint to that. Okay, so these are in the class of models that were studied by Kutasov and collaborators some years ago. So basically, it's QCD with an adjoint. And the adjoint has a cubic superpotential. And then there are mass terms for the different fields, for the adjoint, and there's mass terms for quarks. And we assume that the quarks have a slightly smaller mass term than the adjoints, but both mass terms are much smaller than the Planck scale. So both of these mass terms are meant to be somewhere a little bit above the intermediate scale. They are collectively what I called M hidden sector before, schematically, but now I'm differentiating these two. Okay. So the theory is nothing but SUN gauge theory with an adjoint and F flavors, so N colors and SF flavors of quarks. Okay. And we're going to look in this regime that is needed for the Seiberg, interligator Seiberg Xi model, which is a broad band of flavors. Okay, there's a broad band here. And we want to be somewhere in the middle of this band, but it's not very sensitive to exactly which number of flavors we have. So this model was, let me just say what happens. The dynamics here is, the gauge, this is an asymptotically free theory, but eventually the coupling runs and it runs strong, and what happens is you head towards a fixed point. And at this fixed point, the gauge coupling is strong, this coupling is strong, and if it stays at this fixed point until these masses appear, and they blast you out of the fixed point, okay, the end of the fixed point. So that's what I'm saying, the gauge coupling and the Yukawa coupling here is strong, until MA, which is the first master, where it was pointed out by these guys that the theory then reverts to Suzy QCD, which is the obvious thing you would have guessed. I integrate out A, and boom, I'm in some strongly coupled Suzy QCD. Now, that strongly coupled Suzy QCD theory is, with a non-zero quark mass, is precisely the model studied by interligator Seiberg and Xi earlier this year. And we know that they have a supersymmetry breaking metastable vacuum. They have supersymmetric vacuum states that have been known for donkey's years, but they do, this is the news, that they have metastable vacua, which are long-lived. How long-lived are they? Okay. Well, they're exponentially sensitive to the strong interactions normally in the way these guys study them. These guys study them. The lifetime is proportional to the exponential. That's why you get long lifetimes very without large hierarchies. Lambda QCD divided by MX. Okay, schematically, you've got this. So if you just had a slightly small mass compared to this QC, the strong interaction scale, this thing would live forever, well, for a long time. Okay. Now, the role of the lambda QCD here is being played by MA, because the theory is already at strong coupling, but it's at a fixed point. And then I integrate out MA, and the theory suddenly says, I'm at strong coupling and I'm in QCD. And so MA is playing the role of the lambda QCD. But basically, with only moderate hierarchy here, you can get something that lives a very long time. I should say there's a handsome prefactor here in the exponent, so you really don't need much of a hierarchy before you're living for, you know, 10 billion years. Okay. So that's just their model. That's a stunning, beautiful, simple, and I think its implications for, if you like, the landscape of possibilities is still to be fully appreciated. But the main thing is that there's an F term for one of the mesons made out of these hidden quarks, and it's proportional to the mass that you're putting in for these quarks, and it breaks supersymmetry, and that's so there's the whole plot. There's a conformal regime, and then you break supersymmetry. The real thing that I want to go through in the next transparency, this is the last technical transparency I have, is the exception to the general rule of sequestering. I have an infrared, a strongly coupled infrared attractive fixed point, but there's this little aspect of global symmetries. So let's just go through the symmetries and see what happens. So first of all, let me turn off these small quark masses, because in the regime of conformal sequestering, that is above these masses are small perturbations. Let's forget about them. Let's study what the symmetries are. Well, very naively, you would have said there's, you can rotate the F flavors of quark, the F flavors of anti-quark, you could rotate the A's, and there's a U1R symmetry. Now, the U1R symmetry is never the issue in conformal sequestering. It does not have this extra supermultiplet that's related to it by supersymmetry. So really, it's these non-R symmetries that matter. Of course, we know there are anomalies. So really, the flavor symmetry is this SUFX, this SUF X bar, There's the baryon number. Of course, this is a really hidden baryon number, just saying it quickly. So that's all that comes out of here. There is a U1 axial, which, however, is strongly anomalous. And one can show that that counts, that being strongly anomalous, the associated current is irrelevant. It's driven rapidly to zero. Okay. So it's these symmetries that we worry about. There's also a symmetry where you rotate, a non-anomalous symmetry, where you rotate the Qs, the Xs, you rotate the Xs and the adjoint in different ways, and that's also non-anomalous. However, that normally would be one more bad symmetry to worry about. And this is precisely where we did a little bit of conformal designer engineering of this theory. We added this Yukawa coupling, lambda AQ. In the CFT, which was there before you added this, in fact, there would be this extra symmetry, and it would actually turn out to be a nagging problem. However, we added this, and if you add even a little bit of this, the coupling grows and drives you to a fixed point where this is turned on strong, and rotating A is no longer a symmetry. So both of these are killed. This one is killed for free. This was killed, if you like, by design. Okay. So we're left with these symmetries. And so what should we do about them? However, it's very natural to just gauge the non-abelian flavor symmetry. You don't have to gauge the chiral non-abelian gauge symmetry, just the vector SUF gauge symmetry. As soon as you do that, it turns out that all of these operators associated with either the currents of this or the currents of this cannot be written multiplied by the visible sector. And the reason is very simple. The visible sector is a singlet of this flavor symmetry, whereas all of these are adjoints of the flavor symmetry. So if you gauged it, this is not a gauge invariant operator. Okay, so these are gone. So basically, I don't have to worry about this symmetry, this symmetry, this symmetry, or this symmetry, and we're left with this U1 baryon number. However, U1 baryon number is an accidental symmetry of the entire hidden sector. Okay, and you can prove, I won't do it here, it's proof is too highbrow a word. It's trivial to see, but you have to see it with a piece of paper, that in fact, this current, the current associated with the symmetry of the entire hidden sector, will always get zero Suzy breaking BEV. Okay, so even though it's not sequestered, it just doesn't matter. Okay? So this model, for different reasons, for different sets of currents, none of these currents cause us any trouble. It is also useful to study the same story from the dual point of view in order to catch what I would call emergent symmetries. You see, a fixed point can have two types of symmetries. It can have the symmetries of the parent theory, the asymptotically free theory, which, of course, if there are symmetries there, they end up being symmetries of the fixed point. Those are the ones I've discussed. But what can also happen is the parent theory might not have a symmetry which, however, suddenly shows up at the fixed point. It's an emergent symmetry. And these emergent symmetries, a good place to hunt for them and check they're not there, to the best you can, is to look at dual descriptions. So we've done that. I won't talk about it in great detail. I think I'm pretty much out of time. So therefore, this is a model that, in fact, fits the propaganda. It fully sequesters because of large anomalous dimensions and an attractive fixed point. And it seems like a very simple model. So we have thought a little bit about perturbing it, asking what would happen if the quark masses were all different. You know, a lot of questions. But I'm only going to open up those boxes in response to questions. What I did want to say, just to see if I can shift gears in terms of questions, is to say, okay, how would I connect any of this to anything that happens here, especially in terms of the post-KKLT world of string theory, shall I say? Okay. So one is, look, I just told you a story about a CFT, so surely there must be some dual picture. Now, the CFT I'm talking about doesn't have to have large N. It certainly doesn't have large tuff coupling. But so while every CFT has its ADS dual, it's not a very useful ADS dual. But it's useful enough just to get the conversation going to just draw what this dual story looks like. The picture is really this, okay? The CFT corresponds to everything in green here. The visible sector is put in from the outside. It has nothing to do with the hidden sector. And frankly, gravity, four-dimensional gravity, has got nothing to do with anything I talked about, except to even motivate why you have these Planck-suppressed couplings to start with. Okay. So the blue stuff is being put in from the outside, and everything I talked about technically was the green stuff.
Was it backwards? That's the infrared brain?
This is the infrared brain on which Susie is broken. And we are not solving the hierarchy problem using warp factors. We have supersymmetry for that purpose. So that's why this is over here. Okay. So in terms of some, well, I'll give you a glimpse of what this points to in the stream. But the dual picture is we have some warp throat. Okay, it's got some five dimensions or higher, whatever. It doesn't much matter because we know there are very strong quantum effects. This is not a classically dominated geometry, it's high curvature, it's not very useful to talk of this picture except as a cartoon to inspire us to do something else. Okay. Susy breaking is taking place here in the infrared, but this is like infrared here does not mean TeV, it means 10 to the 12 GeV. What caused the throat to end here was there was a profile for an ADS tachyon, that's the dual of the mass term that we use to break out of the CFT. And this ADS tachyon has a profile which eventually gets so big that its back reaction cannot be ignored. Its gravitational back reaction cannot be ignored. It blasts you out of the warped geometry, and something happens. And that something is the infrared brain. Okay? So this is the dual picture of everything I just talked about. I should say that, in fact, we went in the opposite direction. That is, Luthi and I, many years ago, we're actually more thinking the other way around. We're thinking about warp compactifications and stories very much like this. And so we actually just studied effective field theories of this type, where it turns out the simplest field theory stabilization of the extra dimensions can be done by just adding to the minimal picture a high dimensional Yang-Mills theory, pure Yang-Mills, which after compactification becomes four-dimensional Yang-Mills, which undergoes Giugino compensation, and that stabilizes the story. But one of the things we worked out is we matched the higher-dimensional theory, five-dimensional effective field theory, carefully to the four-dimensional field theory at which all the action takes place, and you get bizarre, but very precise and robust, robust in a sense we could talk about later, Kähler potential. I'm using the obscure supergravity notation, which, however, is standard, to write these Kähler potentials. Okay, and here is a superpotential, which is the result of Giugino condensation. This Giugino condensate depends on the size of the extra dimension, plus some constant superpotential from somewhere else, maybe from the flux energy responsible for stabilizing all the dimensions that I'm not talking about. So this is the picture here, and it's a fairly robust result of just taking the minimal idea of warping and this kind of story. Now, the thing I think is maybe interesting, maybe not, I would like your input, is, of course, this is the kind of picture that we see a lot of nowadays, where the Planck brain is some Calabi-Yau or something. And we can easily imagine the visible sector living on this Calabi-Yau localized on the Planck brain. There's some warped throat, and then Susy breaking at the end of the throat. This is being discussed. We talk about things like that. Now, the kinds of things, so you see, of course, something that generally people like to do or want to do is here's this 10-dimensional story, and I'd like to match it to some four-dimensional effective theory and tell you, here's a Kähler potential, here's a superpotential, go to work, okay? But it's hard. In fact, already you would say, what should I look for? I mean, is there something other than just getting it down, okay, this is the number 2/3, square root of 5, whatever it is, in all the terms, is there something qualitative to shoot for? Well, of course, a sequestering Kähler potential is something to shoot for. I'm just giving an example of something that can be shot for. And it's an interesting thing to look for. But there are some things that lead you to say, sequestering is a fairly robust thing. There are some things that tell you that it's going to happen or not. And one of those things is, what is the nature of the fire? So, as an effective field theorist, I imagine to myself that there is a parameter that can make this throat as large as I want. And I ask no questions. Okay, so I imagine doing that, and I'm looking at this ADS region. And I ask, this is not a five-dimensional space. The radius of curvature of ADS may be comparable to the radius of the other directions, okay, that are compact. But nevertheless, I can Kaluza-Klein decompose to five dimensions and ask, what is the spectrum of masses in five dimensions? Who is massless in five dimensions, and who is massive in five dimensions? And these considerations are just the key things that will determine whether or not, at the end of the day, you're going to get a sequestered form or a non-sequestered form. Okay? And we can go through them. I want to stop here and say, look, I'm willing to talk
about
anything.
You're saying it depends on the spectrum of the throat, not the boundary conditions at the top? I mean, I would have thought it depended on the boundary conditions at the top of the throat rather than the spectrum in the throat.
The boundary conditions at the top are roughly, okay, so there's the visible sector. Let's take the simplest case. Suppose I just say that the only massless five-dimensional field mm-hmm. is actually supergravity. Then, in fact, you are doomed to get the physics of this previous kind of situation. That is, you really are going to get sequestered. Why? Because the basic idea of sequestering from the extra-dimensional point of view is you can always screw up sequestering by coupling a state here to a state here by exchange of a massive field. And you integrate it out, and you get a contact term in the four-dimensional effective field theory, which is the absence of sequestering, right? But of course, this mediation by a massive field will get a Yukawa suppression, e to the minus the mass times the proper distance between the two brains. And you might ask, is this actually the formula in the warped case? And the answer is, yeah, it is, okay? So you get this suppression. This suppression is precisely dual to this effect that I talked about in conformal sequestering. So don't imagine these are one on top of the other. They are physically equivalent as duals. So you're staring at something like this. Now, if the five-dimensional spectrum is such that the M5s are even, let's imagine without large Tuff coupling, that the M5 is of order 1 over RADS. Okay, so we have strong coupling, but we don't have super strong coupling. Okay, we don't have large strong coupling. But even that, you see, is enough. As long as your compactification is many ADS wavelengths, you're still in business. And this rapidly gives you the kind of suppression you need. So it seems to me the interesting kind of thing to do is to ask, given a target, so I'm just giving you one target, which is sequestering, it seems to be a broadly interesting question, is to try and see in the complexity, in looking at all the trees and we're looking trying to find the forest here, is to see, is there something we can look at, is there some way we can diagnose the 10-dimensional information? So we're not trying to literally get every detail right about the final Kähler potential and superpotential of the four-dimensional effective field theory, but rather some broad features. Is it sequestered? Is it not? So, okay, so this is all I had to say. I hope this may connect with some things.
Just another dumb question. At one point you mentioned in your field theory discussion symmetry reasons why certain of these couplings, once you ran down to the scale of interest, were like not suppressed. Are there good ways to see that in the geometrical, supposedly?
Yes.
Picture?
Yes. The a global symmetry. Yeah. Sure. No. Of
these
course.
Broad generic
exactly.
Features,
it's very useful.
That's the one thing that you focused on. So I'm like, what's the dual picture of that?
It's very useful to do exactly that. And a global symmetry of a CFT in the ADS picture is a gauge field in the throat. Okay? So the answer is, so this is what I was claiming was the jewel of our story. That's because we didn't have any of those bad symmetries. But basically, they're non-abelian symmetries are not actually a very deadly thing. You can always gauge them, and they tend. There's a reason. If you talk about a symmetry current like this, a non-abelian symmetry current is charged under the symmetry.
Yes.
So if it's charged, you can't write it down multiplied. If you gauge that symmetry, you can't write it down multiplied by a singlet from the visible sector. Okay. So it's easy. However, a U1 flavor symmetry is bad because it's not charged under itself. You can go ahead and gauge the U1. I don't care. It's not going to save you. Okay. So there's a catch there. Now the problem then becomes U1s in the bulk. Okay, so if you ask, you see, we're in a situation, I was talking to some people who are more familiar with the warped side of the string constructions rather than the CFT side. We're under two lampposts. What's easy to do in CFTs and what's easy to do in large volume string theory, okay? And what's easy in both cases is not always the same thing. That's why it's so useful to look at under both lampposts and try and interpolate and guess what the general structure of the landscape might be. What we're seeing under the lamppost of CFTs is that the central worry, the central delicacy, is, I'm going to switch languages and say U1s in the bulk. And these U1s, because they're gauge fields, are massless, and hence you can't get away with this Yukawa suppression. That's the dual of...
And I would, just very naively from other considerations, expect the gravity story, you know, whatever it looks like, the geometrical story, to be sensitive to those U1s. You know, generally, you find that gravity can represent U1 physics.
You mean on the ADS side that they're... Yeah, so here's the kind of question is, what's the sort of typical inhabitant of the bulk as far as massless guys are concerned?
And
are there U1s?
Does the story of boundary conditions rather matter regarding that?
No. Because, you see, you could always say, I have a U1 in the bulk, or I have a massless field in the bulk, but there's a brain-localized mass term for it. Does that save me? And it doesn't, because you see...
Because it doesn't propagate in the bulk.
This is the Yukawa suppression factor. The fact that there's a mass brain, mass term there or there makes no difference. Thanks. And in fact, for many of these flavor symmetries to be worried about, they do get mass terms here. They are broken here, but that in itself doesn't save you.
So we've been thinking some about warped supersymmetry breaking, and I'm trying to think of this a little bit more concretely, what would go wrong or what you should check for. So let's suppose you have a warped throat with supersymmetry breaking somewhere, maybe because of fluxes. Okay. So you've got one, and let's suppose you have another throat,
sure,
a collection of brains somewhere that has a visible sector on it.
Right.
Let's suppose, say, the flavor symmetries come about because you have different stacks of brains or something,
sure,
some symmetry acting there. So you're saying what one should look for is simply any massless fields that can mediate interactions between the two?
In the bulk, as opposed to just living on this brain.
Yeah, so if you've stabilized all the moduli, for example, that's, well, then you've gotten rid of, well...
Let me put it like this. Yeah. You might even have some light moduli here, okay?
Yeah.
As long as they are not allowed to propagate in this throat, but they are localized
here.
These light moduli, as far as my analysis would be concerned, would be saying they are part of the visible sector, broadly speaking, okay? They couple to it. And in fact, this idea of Pomerol and Rotazzi, which is a very beautiful idea for solving the tachyonic slepton problem of anomaly mediation, was to assume a class of models with exactly that feature. They had sort of visible moduli coupled to the visible sector and completely sequestered, however, from Suzy breaking. And then to use the anomaly mediated formulas to just work out what happens here and for the right choices, or right qualitative choices, those models were great. And some of the singlets you might see it, might not see at the LHC. I mean, you might see them not being there, missing energy at the LHC or something. But, yes, I'm saying that light fields here will change the phenomenology but they won't change the fact that the model is sequestered.
Yeah.
And in fact, it may be useful.
Well, so what do you think would go wrong in a typical, you know, KKLT thing along the lines that I described with two throats and all the moduli fixed?
I don't see it. I don't see what can go wrong. If you give me that much, you know, if you tell me, look, there are U1s or there's lots of...
What about the exclusive client states in the throat, right? Because there's an extra phi sphere or something.
Sure.
And what do they...
Well, that falls into this category.
That they're all suppressed?
Yeah.
They're all suppressed?
They have masses of inverse RADS.
Which is about the same as...
As long as the Compton wavelength of those Calypso Klein excitations of the sphere, say, is smaller than the size of the compactification, you will get your Yukawa suppression. So in the long throat limit, you always win by this filtering mechanism. Now there's the details. Is it long enough for the real world? Are these masses big enough?
I mean, at some level, in KKLT, what the lightest things are, for example, the Kähler moduli. Right? You fix the complex structure moduli.
That's over in the bulk.
You worried about light stuff essentially in the strongly coupled hidden sector.
Yeah, actually, can I point out the word light? There's a deadly light and there's a safe light, and I better be clear about that. Let me just say that there are moduli that could get five-dimensional masses. Okay, there are moduli which might have zero five-dimensional mass, but they might get mass in the four-dimensional effective theory. So they do get masses, but here's a simple way. Have a massless field here and give it boundary conditions which are Neumann, okay? Sorry, Dirichlet. Okay? Give it Dirichlet boundary conditions, but it's a massless field in the bulk, of course.
Yeah.
It's going to be, now that would not be good because it could do damage. It can still, it's massless from the five-dimensional point of view, can still do damage. One such modulus would be the, at first sight, would be the radion of the throat, if you like. Okay. Now, it turns out that it's not robustly either a problem or light.
That's related to a Kähler modulus, I think.
The throat length?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's, related to the universal Kähler modulus.
So this is what Ruti and I studied through a number of different versions, and there seemed to be something that we are finding rather generally to be true, which is, you see, I've gone and written an effective potential which involves a modulus called T, and T is, in fact, the radion of the throat, okay? And it does get an F term, and it's not even a tiny F term at the end of the day. Significant. But basically, it doesn't talk to the visible sector because it's, if you like, the radion is like a graviton orthogonal to the Planck brain. So, for a geometric reason, it is not coupled to the visible sector so as to transfer its effort. But,
Moreover, if it is the.
I would only say that that's the only exception. You know, that's the only exception in the sense that we have a general reason why. A, it is light. So this paper by Shamet and collaborators recently was basically pointing to this fact that you want sequestering, you want a big extra dimension. Well, a big extra dimension has a radion for that big extra dimension, and its mass is going to be generated at the 4D level, not at the 5D level where it's all part of gravity. So that's going to be something that's not going to sequester. But that's the one guy that does not talk to the visible sector and who cannot do any harm. And in these fully worked out effective field theories, that's what we're finding. The other moduli in the throat, coming from the phi sphere or whatever else is up there, you do have to worry about them getting 5D masses. Yes. So that's the question.
So you want the extra 5-manifold of narrow isometries.
That would be good.
You have to worry about any.
So isometries would turn into gauge fields.
And that's right. In any two cycles or three cycles that I can reduce Verona rum fields on unless you can find somebody to eat them.
Yeah. And as I say, of those isometries, it's the U1 isometries right. that bother me the most. So that's in the checklist of things. If you're looking for new things to worry about beyond what is obvious from my talk, right. then I would have said is the moduli, which are not isometries. They're not gauge fields. They're just not gauge fields. They're moduli, which are getting mass at the 4D level, but they are massless fields in the throat. So they're boundary conditions which are giving them mass ultimately, but in the throat they're massless and they can do damage and we should worry about
it. You said they're candidate-like scalars or axiom-like scalars.
Now the fact that it can be that throats exist, you know, there are two ways of doing string theory analysis, I gather, from having been here for 2 days, which is where you either compactify or you don't. So if you like, the model I gave you in detail was a model where you don't, and you hope that the aspects of compactification don't completely change the whole picture, that there's enough examples which are fully compact, which are true to the picture you're getting like this. Well, the picture you're getting like this from the field theory side, from the CFTs that I know to engineer, is that the throat moduli, which could cause damage, are quite robustly not there, okay? That it's quite easy to see why you don't have massless fields racing up and down here. The most robustly bad massless field in the bulk are gauge fields, five-dimensional gauge fields. And so I have great hope for sequestering from the point of view of worrying about light moduli here. Yeah. I don't know whether it's easy to do near your lamppost, but it's very easy to do near my lamppost.
Well, let's address that. If you take sort of a generic KKLT thing, you don't think it will have five-dimensional gauge fields, right? You need something special to happen for that to be. Okay, so let's look at the light spectrum. It has the moduli, complex structure, and Kalin moduli. Complex structure moduli get flux-induced masses. I think those are five-dimensional masses, okay. Basically. And so the only question is, how do we think of the Kalor moduli and whether those are really five-dimensional masses or not? Now, I'm not certain on that. When you generate this potential, you know, a la KKLT, non-determinative effects, that probably is the essential question, whether that's what you would call a 5D fan.
Well, if these are non-perturbative effects, then are these things generated as after compactification? So I don't know.
You can understand them up in the 10D theory. In terms of the 10D physics.
Yes, and then that makes it tricky. Let me just say why I said that and see if it rings any bells. In this very simple field theory stabilization, very reminiscent of instanton type of stabilization, you know, instanton mediated stabilizations or gauge genome mediated, gauge genome condensation stabilization mechanism. The way this works is 5D Yang-Mills is actually asymptotically non-free in five dimensions. It's weakly coupled. There's absolutely nothing interesting about this 5D Yang-Mills until you get to the compactification scale, where all of a sudden it switches over to being asymptotically free, and the coupling grows in the infrared. There's gauge genome condensation. It generates a little potential for the radion, and boom, you're in business. But that means, from the 5D point of view, you see absolutely no indication of what's to come. I mean, the gauge genome condensation, which, if I have to say it in hadronic terms, just to turn into the string theorist in this warp space, it's as if the gauge genome condensation is happening when, if you like, the hadrons have to sort of span the extra dimensions. They have to feel the boundaries before they can tell that they are supposed to, hey, look, this is not n equals 2 higher dimensional Yang-Mills, it's just n equals 1, do something. That happens because they sense the brains. It's somehow not intrinsic to the throat, which makes me say that this modulus, the T modulus, is getting its mass at the 4D level. I hope I'm saying something which is not merely words, though, because it matters whether it's 5D or 4D mass. Mm-hmm. I don't know the kind of effects that give your Kalor moduli their mass. Are they somehow very sensitive? That's why, again, as a non-string theorist, it's very easy for me to imagine taking some parameter that takes these brains away, and I say, well, are you getting anything? Are you getting mass now? And the answer is yes or no for you guys, but I don't know technically how you would do that for you guys.
A truly compact model doing this is not easy. A simple way to probe it is if you test a non-compact model, okay? Where if you could just look at models where you're, you know, doing this, then you might actually be able to ask this question sensibly, like, are you getting masses even without having...
Well, I think in that limit, for a lot of these things, the masses do go to zero.
So that would, that's telling right there.
Well, I'm not so sure. Those are masses that would be masses in the five-dimensional sense.
Yeah.
But they depend on the size of the group.
Oh, sorry, they're going to zero because of the warp factor?
No, they're going to zero because they depend on the size of the whatever the compact part that you stick on.
Right. But I don't understand. This compact part is some finite size, so what is...
That compact part.
Oh, this compact
part.
Right. I see. They go to zero. Oh, no. Sorry. Wait, that might be okay. Let me just say it again. Okay. You're saying you are finding zero masses because you put on the... That's like in RS or something. You have a massless graviton precisely because you put the Planck brain there. You get a normally non-normalizable mode, which now becomes normalizable and... If that's what's happening, of course, that mode morally lives near the Planck brain or on the Planck brain, and it doesn't hurt us.
I'm confused why you say you know what goes on in KKLT, because what you need to add to the usual KKLT story is some strongly coupled gauge theory, which gives you the slump code and does the sequestering for you, right?
No. Well,
otherwise, what's
well, you could have the usual kind of long throat that you have.
Right. There has to be a long throat of this type, and it seems like all the questions are questions about this long throat.
Yeah.
And that's where you should. So here's why you know from KKLT that this generically won't happen. It's a great question. About what?
Well, it's a question.
It's a question about what you can sort of add to KKLT to give you what.
So I guess I'm saying that if you do the full KKLT-like construction, you get many details. It's not exactly obvious what you should focus on. And maybe a useful thing to do is look at the non-compact case, presumably a lot simpler. And if you study the throat, you should be able to tell.
Actually, there's something funny that happens in the non-compact case, now that I'm thinking about it properly, and that is when you take sort of the limit when that thing goes to infinite size, at the same time the throat gets eaten up and disappears.
You mean it actually disappears?
You cut it off further and further down until you don't, roughly speaking, until you don't.
So you're not saying this happens, the throat gets...
No, it's as if the throat stays fixed, but you're chopping off more and more.
Oh, I see, I see. Got it.
Is that a good place to stop?
Since it's 5 to 2, possibly.
Well,